Friedman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks so much for joining us.
This is KBOO Portland. Coming up next at 8, the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show discusses the mass incarceration of children and the real impact of Trump's policies, and they take your calls. At 9, on Alternative Radio, best-selling author Michael Pollan offers his notes from the psychedelic underground. At 10, you'll hear Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, Peace, Love, and Soup puts the focus on Generation Z's poets, musicians, activists, and free thinkers. All of this KBOO programming is made possible by your support. If you're not a member and you'd like to become one, please go to kboo.fm and click on Donate.
Are you bored or unsatisfied with your daily activities? Do you long for a new, exciting experience? If the answer is yes and you're under 21 just like me, then you should consider adding a once-a-week KBOO Youth Collective meeting to your schedule. Side effects will probably include extreme happiness, uncontrollable fits of laughter, a great group of new friends, and yummy snacks. KBOO Youth Collective can cause sudden bouts of inspiration and a yearning to share your words or your inner thoughts with the local community. If joining the collective sounds like a cure for your boredom and lack of an extraordinary after-school activity, then write us at youth@kboo.org or visit us at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, or come into one of our Wednesday meetings for a scare-free, risk-free, and always cost-free trial.
Hi, I'm Bob Madar, inviting you to come on over to Local Folks Podcast and listen to episode number 6 to discover how a local nonprofit in Corvallis, Oregon, provides essential and effective support to gleaners so they can help low-income people feed their families and heat their homes. You can find Local Folks at kboo.fm. Go to audio, list of programs, podcast, web only, and click on Local Folks.
I don't know if everybody knows.
Well, that's part of why we're here, Joe, so that everybody can know.
Yes, obviously. This is KBOO 90.7 on your FM dial in Portland, Oregon. That's Abe Proctor. I'm Joe Uris. It's the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show at KBOO 231-8187. And I got a couple, three things, but you are the master of ceremonies.
Yeah, we're going to talk about the children being held in detention camps.
Yeah, yeah. Well, they're bad children. Bad.
Okay, we'll talk about that. but before we do, you have a couple items that both popped up in the Oregonian over the weekend.
Well, it's interesting. They're actually letters to the
editor.
That's
so cute. You've got little cutout pieces of newspaper taped with Scotch tape to your notepad.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, that's a professional technique.
So 20th century.
I am a 20th century kind of person.
We know.
For sure.
We all know, Joe.
Yeah, I am a Luddite, proudly so. More and more I discover how bad the net really is. Okay, not enough of that. It turns out that Washington, probably Oregon, are going to be homes to methanol refineries that are toxic, deadly, even when they're operating efficiently. This is a thing that you should find out about and you should oppose. And I'm going to just say, I mean, that's enough. You need to give written comments to the port of Kalama before the 28th. I want to emphasize that this is a near disaster waiting to happen if they build that plant. Now, the other one is probably more significant in terms of what's going on. If you watched the Daddy Bush funeral and you thought, oh, well, he's a good conservative. He's the kind of conservative we want. Forget about it. He was the guy who started using depleted uranium in warfare. He was the guy who has sprayed, had in essence sprayed depleted uranium on tanks, on buildings, on people all over the Middle East. And American soldiers, many of them exposed to this, are now bearing the impacts of that. I wanted to emphasize both of these. And I want to add one other thing. And this is a big surprise. I want to remind you that it's been 50 years of resist. Resist is the best, most pure fight against war. And, you know, it's a group headed by all kinds of people against illegitimate authority. There are people like Allen Ginsberg, now gone, and others who organized resist during the Vietnam War. It's still going. It's still good. And you should be supporting it. And that's enough of that. Now we go, and don't call about those, please. Now we go to what's really on our mind.
You know, telling your radio audience not to call about something?
Yeah, I am. Yeah. I am. Those things, I don't want to have the conversation about those things.
I know. That's the easiest way to guarantee people will call about those things.
You think so?
I do.
You're trying to prompt people to call?
No.
Well,
no,
then shut your mouth.
I'm saying there's a bunch of contrarians amongst our listenership who are going to call up just to talk about those things.
Well, all right. I can live with that if that happens.
As you know, if you've been following the news and if you've been following this show, you know that there have been unprecedented levels of, what's the word I'm looking for?
Cruelty.
Cruelty.
Yes, that's
that
the
wasn't
word.
The word, but that works. Cruelty.
Yeah.
Put in place as at our border with Mexico in order to keep groups of migrants from crossing the border to find asylum in the United States.
But I want to emphasize, you're probably going to say this, but I want to say it too. Nobody crossing the border in this context is doing anything illegal. They're doing exactly what they're supposed to do.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that, because it's important to understanding this whole situation. It is not illegal to present yourself at a border in order to claim asylum.
Right.
That's how it's done.
Yeah.
Under international law. In fact, there really is no other way to do it.
Yes.
But to come to the place where you're trying to gain asylum and ask for it. That's how people move from a bad situation into a better one, hopefully.
Hopefully.
Right. There's also the thing that we must bear in mind when thinking about this whole situation, and that is the term illegal immigrant, or the shorter, more pejorative term illegal, as in let's get all these illegals out of here, is in fact inaccurate. It is not illegal to be in the United States without documentation.
Right.
It is a civil infraction.
Right.
Much like jaywalking or driving too fast, something like that.
Well,
it's not a crime.
It's not a crime. That's the point, yes.
So to use that pejorative, illegal, is inaccurate, and one might suspect used in order to gin up contempt and hatred and fear of those people whose presence you don't like.
Well, sure. I mean, you got a racist president, you got a racist Republican Party, of course you're going to make people paranoid.
Indeed. So in addition to the legal technicality that we're talking about here, that in fact nobody is here illegally, you can only be here without documentation.
Well, how can you be an illegal person?
Well, that's where I'm getting at. No human being is illegal.
Right.
It's absurd on its face. And anybody with an ounce of compassion, I think, should be able to discern that pretty clearly. Those without an ounce of compassion seem to be in charge of the Border and Customs Enforcement Agency. What's going on there, and what has been going on there, if we're being honest, for a long time, for years, but more visibly and perhaps more viscerally under the Trump administration, is a particular brand of performative cruelty that sells to the conservative base, the conservative electorate in this country.
Well, the racist crowd.
The racist crowd, yeah. When they see Trump kicking brown people when they're down, they like that. They cheer that on.
I'd like to think they are maybe thinking about it again.
You think so?
I hope. I pray. I don't even believe in God, and I'm praying.
Last week, according to the Washington Post and many other media outlets, a seven-year-old girl from Guatemala died of dehydration and shock after she was taken into border control custody, a crossing from Mexico into the United States. Along with her father and a large group of migrants. This was in New Mexico.
Yeah, a very obscure location in
New Mexico. Very obscure location where they attempted to make the crossing. They were apprehended, detained by Border Control, and this girl was not given a medical examination, died of dehydration and shock, as I just mentioned, after having spent a long period of time with a very, very high fever, in excess of 105 degrees Fahrenheit. If you know anything about kids and their health, that's a dangerously high. That's dangerously high for anybody.
Yeah, yeah.
This is an abominable situation. This girl was taken into custody, separated from her dad, not given medical care, not given a medical examination, and not given any food and water, died in the custody of United States Border Patrol agents at the hands of our taxpayer-funded personnel. It's a disgusting and revolting and abominable situation. And I predict that it probably won't be the last.
I think what's going on our border is actually illegal. I believe that essentially it is based on racism. It is based on stereotypes, negative stereotypes of persons south of our border. It is vicious. It is ugly. And as in the case of all these things, it's simply a scapegoat for a failing regime.
Yeah. Yeah, I would agree with that. Aside from the horrible tale of this little girl, the number of children in detention at the border facilities, which are camps, these are tented camps in the middle of the desert, constructed to hold children in prison.
But they are learning how to make a military bed.
Okay. Almost 15,000 children now are in custody at our border facilities. I don't think you can describe this in any other way as being held in concentration camps.
But they are learning to make a bed.
They are learning to make a bed. They're not being forced to labor. Let's be clear here. But they are being detained, separated from their parents for extended periods of time. There has been an intentional starvation of resources that has taken place in terms of providing appropriate personnel to process these people's claims of asylum. So they're left to wait in tents in the middle of the desert, separated from their families in what is an effective political and social limbo until such time as the Trump administration can decide what to do with them.
But they are learning to march in lines, and they are learning not to hug each other.
They're learning not to hug each other.
Yeah, it's not allowed.
It's not allowed.
Seriously.
So even the smallest human comforts are denied.
Right.
Kids.
Yeah.
Kids being held in camps in the desert can't even hug each other.
No, this is true. I'm not making that up.
Oy.
Yeah.
So as I suggested earlier, this is part of a larger pattern of performative cruelty and also unabashed, unvarnished, out in the open racism that characterizes the Trump administration and its followers. At this point, if you are a supporter of Donald Trump,
oh, we don't have, I don't think anybody is.
No, but, you know, everybody knows somebody, right?
Yeah.
Everybody knows somebody or is related to somebody. I'm starting to wonder if you might not just be suffering a lapse in judgment, but might be a bad person.
Ooh, there's no bad people.
I don't
just
know
bad
about
behavior.
That, 503-231-8187 is the number to call. Let's go to Edie.
Hi, Edie, you're on the air.
I was at Longview for the hearing against...
Edie, I have to interrupt you on this one because I agreed with my partner that I would tell about these events, but we would not take them on as topics for discussion by the audience. I really agree with you on Longview. I'm just going to have to cut you off, though, because I made a deal.
That's not you. No,
I made
no,
a deal, Edie. No. I'm sorry.
Wait.
Go ahead. Mm. I'm cruel. I know.
All right, let's go to Harvey.
There.
Good morning, Harvey.
Excuse me. Well, I feel that a lot of this can be avoided because a lot of the reasons that these people are climate change refugees is because of extreme drought in those countries.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel that instead of spending money on the wall, which is millions and just unbelievable amounts of money, that if they just use three off-the-shelf technologies, one would be industrial dehumidifiers. These are dehumidifiers. They pull water out of the air and would be powered by solar panels, and then they can use drip irrigation for irrigation of the crops. And those three off-the-shelf technologies can be used if our government invests a little bit of money in that sort of thing and helps these people in their communities, then they wouldn't have to migrate up here because they could grow the food that they need, even though there's an extreme drought going on.
Okay, so dehumidifier to extract whatever moisture remains in the air and then use it to irrigate crops, is that what you mean?
That's right, because, there's if you Google the words industrial dehumidifiers, there's these companies that make these machines that pull water out of the air for industrial reasons, but they can also be put on towers with a little, like a collection, you know, water tower. And they
wait a minute, is this happening? I mean, is this something that's real?
It's very real. I'm talking about off-the-shelf technology here. You can Google.
No, I understand the technology exists. I'm asking if this is happening at this time.
I don't know if it's happening. I'm saying this is a way to avert a lot of these climate refugees.
Oh, I see. I got you. Okay.
Yeah. If we invest in them locally and help them pull water out of the air. So it's basically, it's an open cycle. The water feeds the plants and it goes back into the system. And so it would be, you know, and because these technologies are already there, they've been there for a longest time, and they can just put them together and help communities and small farmers irrigate their crops, and therefore they wouldn't have to become climate change refugees.
Well, I think it's a very interesting idea. I'm going to go on to someone else, though, but I think I would need to look into that more, because I still believe in the conservation of matter. I don't see how you produce water magically. You're merely converting it from one place to another, but it might well work.
Well, yeah, that's exactly what he's talking about.
Yeah.
Moving it from one place to another.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's something magical happening here. It's the sound physics he's discussing.
Sound physics, but... I have a problem with the idea that you take water out of the air, you put it into the ground, and then it creates crops, and then it returns to the air, and then you take it out again. It may be something that can be done. Can it be done effectively? Can it be done economically? Can it be done practically?
I don't know. That's a very good question. Okay, according to the Chicago Tribune, at the Tornillo Detention Center at the border, one of these tent cities we've been talking about, a facility that you should be surprised, shocked even, to learn is not administered by the federal government, but is in fact contracted to somebody.
Well, of course. There's got to be a profit involved somewhere.
Actually, the operation of this facility was, the contract was awarded to a nonprofit.
Oh, that's nice.
That, well, maybe, maybe not. It sounds like they're cutting corners, much like a for-profit entity might. There's only one mental health clinician for every 50 children at the facility. That's about one-fifth as many as the government mandates at its official detention centers. So it's unclear at this point why this regulation has not been enforced and why this place is being allowed to operate with insufficient staffing. But at this very same facility, Tornillo, staffers there or administrators there have been permitted to waive background checks for many of its employees.
What?
Yeah.
So preverts can be doing this?
All kinds of people. They're skipping the fingerprinting background check portion of their pre-employment screening process. So what we have essentially here is a detention camp for children being staffed by people whose backgrounds have not been thoroughly investigated and understaffed in terms of mental health personnel available to minister to these kids, many of whom are right in the midst of a living and ongoing traumatic situation.
I'm sure it's okay because they're Christians.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure it's not okay. Let's go to the phone. Sue, you're next.
Hi. I totally agree. This whole thing at the border is just awful. And, of course, we all know that the Border Patrol is purposely keeping these people in Mexico so they have to go through unapproved checkpoints and things like that. But I do need to set you straight. Do you guys know who Norman Goldman is, the talk show host?
Yeah, I've heard of him. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay. So he did research on this girl. And yes, we know there's a lot of children being neglected and stuff, but in this particular case, they did do a medical exam. They did give her food and water, but the problem was she was... The theory is she was really too far gone at the state of dehydration she was in. She really needed to be taken to a hospital immediately and given intravenous fluids. Mm-hmm. And so it's not that they kept her from drinking and eating. They just didn't bring her to the hospital.
Nobody here is suggesting that she was deliberately dehydrated.
No, I know. But he did mention that he did say during the intro that they didn't give her food and water, and that is incorrect.
Okay. Well, thank you for setting us straight.
But I totally hope, I mean, but that does not negate any of the bad things that are happening at the border, which I totally, thoroughly disagree with, and I hope we can figure out ways to stop these guys.
Okay, thanks for the call.
Yeah, thanks very much for the call.
I'm not
clear about this. My understanding is there's two arguments. The argument, the government justification is, well, she was already so messed up from her trip, therefore it's her father's fault when she got to that border station. One reason that I find contradiction in that is that we have created a situation where the normal border crossings, for example, Tijuana, are not taking people in any reasonable way. The Border Patrol is actually preventing people from registering seeking asylum. So the whole system has become corrupted and degenerates into a situation of panic and people desperately trying to cross the border. Then there's the question of, well, she needed IV fluids immediately. Well, medics could have given her IV fluids had there been medics. She could have been flown by helicopter had there been a helicopter. There's no excuse. When she comes into American hands, she is the responsibility of the American government, and the government failed her. Whatever else was going on, however her condition was, they failed her and she died. And I think that's really important to understand.
I think that is incredibly important to understand. And also this notion that somehow her father or her family should be to blame for having brought her this great distance under harrowing and difficult circumstances, it's hogwash, and it's morally repugnant on its face. And here's why. The suggestion there is that if this family faced circumstances in their native country in Guatemala that were so dire that they felt their only option was to undertake this long and dangerous journey to the United States, where they might be granted asylum and a chance at making a better life for themselves. If that's what they were facing, to suggest that instead of bringing his daughter on this voyage, that they should have stayed behind where things were so bad, is repugnant. What sort of argument is that? It's his fault for bringing her all this way? What, so he should have stayed in a situation that was untenable?
Well, that's I agree with you, but that's really irrelevant to the fact that this was clearly a sick child, and that the treatment that could be and should have been available, which is immediate IV fluids and immediate movement to a hospital by helicopter, was not carried out. They put her on a bus, and not an air-conditioned bus, by the way, and they drove her, what was it, 90-odd miles?
I don't know how far they drove, but it's not irrelevant, Joe, because these are the arguments being put forth not only by people in positions of power and influence, but by their supporters all across the country. Oh, well, he shouldn't have done this. What was he thinking?
Yeah, I guess that's true. But, you know, the disturbing lack of humanity that we're seeing brought forth by having this fascist regime just keeps echoing on and on and on through the culture, and I'm disgusted by it, and I'm not going to be justifying it in any way.
I don't think it can.
I think we agree on
that. I think we do agree on that. There's a larger question here. What do you do when thousands of refugees arrive at your border seeking asylum? What is the proper enlightened response under that set of circumstances?
Well, what is the humanitarian response?
That's the
key expression.
The humanitarian response. The answer, obviously, I think, it's not to send a regiment of American troops to the border and characterize those asylum seekers who are there as violent
or
and
criminals.
As terrorists or as gang members or criminals. That's not the humanitarian response. Sending soldiers is not the humanitarian response. Instead of a chunk of the army, we should have sent an army of lawyers and judges and clerks
and doctors and nurses
and counselors to help mitigate or to expedite these people's claims of asylum.
Well, yes, of course. And I think that it's really important to understand, first of all, that this whole business of scooping people up, trying to get into the United States to earn a living, has been going on for a long, long time. Since the braceros were introduced to the United States during World War II in order to do the farm work when so many people were drafted into the army, so many American citizens to fight that war, this has been an issue. I can remember as a teenager watching the Border Patrol across from Camp Pendleton on what was then Highway 101 and watching them on 395, which later became I-15 in Southern California, scooping up these people, hapless people. And I always, even then, without any real political sophistication, thought it was an ugly and vicious process. And, you know, there's no excuse for this, and it's not a rational process. In fact, in Portland, in almost anywhere, there are lots and lots and lots of people, many of them undocumented, many of them documented, who are earning a living at jobs that apparently most American citizens aren't interested in doing, and doing those jobs well. And they're going to be disappearing. I think the biggest irony will be when Mr. and Mrs. Rich Guy turn around and realize nobody's going to mow the lawn except them. You know, I'm sorry, but I see a certain irony in that.
Yeah. Ironies abound in all discussions of the Trump regime. Our senator from Oregon, Jeff Merkley,
yay,
has made this a cause. When I say this, I mean the detention of children at the border. On December the 15th, just a couple of days ago, he tweeted the following. I just left the tent city at Tornillo. It is a child prison camp. They refused our request to speak with the children who are held there. The vast majority of these children have parents or other family members who are ready to sponsor them in the United States, but the Trump administration has deliberately created a bottleneck so that it's difficult for the children to be released. They're also threatening to hand over any undocumented family members to ICE, thus discouraging sponsors from coming forward. So thousands of children are living in a tent prison in the desert for months on end.
But they do have they learn how to make beds, and they do learn to march in order, and they learn not to touch each other. No hugging.
You keep saying these things, but I'm beginning to think maybe they're not constructive lessons.
I think they have to do with the militarization of the process, of the stereotypical way in which these people are treated as prisoners when they've committed no crime.
There's literally reams of data about what happens to people who are exposed to significant periods of trauma or incidences of trauma as children.
Right.
It's really hard to bounce back from that. It's hard to live anything like what most people would consider to be a normal life with normal goals and aspirations. These children, these kids, are being damaged every day they remain in these camps, every day they remain separated from the rest of their families, every day that they have to undergo these conditions, and every day that all of this stuff that you've been sort of half-jokingly referring to becomes normalized in their
lives. I'm not joking. I'm saying that this is what they're doing. They're militarizing these children.
Yeah.
It's not a joke. It's a good example of a fascist policy being carried out on hapless children.
Yeah, it's appalling on every level, and it needs to stop. I'm glad we have at least one U.S. senator who's picked up the torch on this cause.
Well, we have a lot of new people in the Congress, many of them who are bilingual. There were people there who could talk with these kids, and they weren't allowed to. So essentially, the children are held in isolation, away from people who speak their language, as far as we know.
Yeah. Speaking the language, I'm glad you mentioned that. According to the Associated Press, right before this 70-year-old Guatemalan girl died in U.S. custody, her father signed a form stating that his daughter was in good health. But we've learned since then that the form was in English, and this gentleman doesn't speak English. In fact, Spanish is his second language. His native tongue is a Mayan dialect. So he was trying to understand a form two languages removed from anything he has experience with. So is it really any wonder that there was confusion here? Again, this is due to inadequate staffing, inadequate resources to handle the real everyday plight of these human beings who are trying to come over the border into the country. It's criminal.
Yeah, but I go further than you. I think it's a deliberate policy. It borders on genocide. It has that aspect of disinterest in the lives of people. And it's disgusting, and it's absolutely typical of the fascist opportunism of the Trump administration.
All right, let's go to the phones. Barth is next.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning. Cheer me up, Barth.
Well, let me try. I'm going to go back to Abe's remark saying that these kids are in a legal limbo. I come from a Catholic background, though I've left it behind largely, but I believe they're in a purgatory legally, where you are tormented between earth and heaven. but we'll just throw that aside. The person that was talking about industrial dehumidifiers and using that to hydrate the soil, I didn't catch the beginning of his remarks, but the process of taking humidity out of the air means there has to be some humidity in the air. So areas that are drought-ridden don't have air humidity, generally speaking. So there's nothing to take out. There's nothing to extract, and there is an energy penalty to do that. In industrial plants and stuff, they can do that if they're trying to get the area to be climate-conditioned. But you have to have moisture to take away.
Well, right. It essentially defies the conservation of matter.
Well, not in its essence, but if he's trying to do this
in practical terms,
a level to help in this specific situation, if there's no moisture in the air, you can't recover the moisture.
Okay. Well, so, I agree, and I think we should go on there, people in line. But your point is valid.
All right. Thanks for the call. You do realize that you can't defy the law of conservation of matter.
Well, right? It doesn't work out.
Well, it's either going to work or it won't work.
Well,
if it works, it's not because of magic.
Right.
Okay. I just want to make sure we understand.
I believe in magic.
All right. Let's go back to the phones. Who's next? Heber. Do we say that right?
Yeah, that's right.
All right. Good morning.
I just thought to mention the way I see it, though, generally, this is the whole immigration issue in the first place. It's Reagan's Frankenstein coming back home. Because remember how, they sold weapons to Iran so they could fund the cocaine infrastructure in South America. Then we overthrew the governments that we didn't like down there and created a criminal organizations all over the place. And because their countries are, completely falling apart, they're coming up here for asylum. They're coming up here to be safe. So this is Frankenstein's monster coming home.
Well, I think that's true. Look, if there were not a huge demand for drugs out of Latin America, many of these people would be safe and happy in their homelands. Also, if the United States had not messed with Central America over the years, beginning with the Monroe Doctrine, by the way, and turning to the United Fruit Company and so on, our support of dictatorships throughout that region, most of these people would be quite happy and quite satisfied to live in their own countries. The United States, created this problem, and now we, the United States, is being punitive toward the people who are fleeing horrors in those lands. And by the way, the gangs that are talked about by Trump and so on, they weren't created in Central America. They were actually created in the L.A. region and moved to Central America, and that's an important point.
Yeah, they're the Salvadoran protecting themselves from the local Mexicans there. But yeah, my memory went as far back as Reagan, because that's when I grew up. But yeah, I didn't even know about the Monroe Doctrine and the new stuff about Dole and the fruit companies. But yeah, I guess it's gone on for a lot longer than I thought even.
Oh yeah,
but I'm just like, it's usually yesterday's solutions are now today's problems, and America doesn't quite get that sometimes.
I think that's an important point, and I think it comes to a head when you have a fascist leader. I'm going to let you go, give some others an opportunity.
All right, you are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM on your radio dial. In my humble opinion, the best radio station in the universe.
Possibly the only one that does what we do.
Quite possibly the only one. Coming up this morning on KBOO at 9, alternative radio bestselling author Michael Pollan offers his notes from the psychedelic underground. Great author. I've read several of his books.
Yeah, he drops some acid, man. Thinks he's so cool.
Okay. At 10, you'll hear Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, Peace, Love, and Soup puts the focus on Generation Z's... What's Generation Z?
XYZ?
Yeah. What?
They skipped Y?
I don't know.
Why?
They started. I'm a member of what's colloquially known as Generation X. And for the record, I would like to say
what
yes.
What am I? What, V?
I have no idea.
Generation A.
This is, for the record, the dumbest way to name generations I've ever
seen. It's a bullpucky thing.
All right. Peace, Love, and Soup puts the focus on Generation Z's, whoever they are, poets, musicians, activists, and free thinkers. I guess there won't be any more generations. Z is the last one.
Right. Well, it could be X prime. Z prime. I mean, you know, what is this stupid stuff?
It's pretty stupid. 503-231-8187 is the number. Take part in this conversation. Engineer Ray informs us Generation Z people were born from the mid-90s to the mid-2000s. Congratulations, Generation Z, for I'm not sure what, but congratulations.
I think it's just all bullpucky.
If you want to comment on the Facebook page, you can do that, facebook.com/AbeandJoe. We're also taking your tweets on the Twitter machine at HonestAbe72. So, Joe,
yes.
This situation at the border.
Yes.
How do we resolve it? If you could wave a magic wand.
If you were in charge.
No. Let's take the magic wand away. If you were in charge, if you were in charge with the resources at hand, with the infrastructure and institutions at your disposal, what steps would you take to mitigate this situation?
You follow the law.
It's really
that simple. People present themselves saying they need to be admitted because they are suffering from political or other kinds of disastrous situations in their homeland. They need asylum. You have as many people as you need to interview these people to see whether or not their needs and their complaints are legitimate. And then you move them into situations where they can be placed in the United States. It's not a hard thing to do. You also have to change American policy toward these countries, which has created these dictatorships, these totalitarian regimes, and the drug cartels that are all about selling narcotics and cocaine and so on in the United States. You have to close that down. And in order to close that down, you have to deal with the problem in the United States. So there's two things. First of all, you obey the law, and you put enough people there so that people's claims can be processed appropriately. And secondly, you do something about the situation in the United States, which has been since the 60s pretty much out of control.
I don't think you're going to do away with demand for narcotics in the United States.
Why not?
Narcotics, I'm using in a very broad term. I realize that it's not
applicable
to every drug.
Well, we're including cocaine, right, which is not a narcotic.
No, not narcotic. That's what I mean. But for the purposes of argument, it works. It's a good word. I don't think you're going to get rid of demand for narcotics in the United States.
Well, you can make them legal.
That's where I was going with this. So possible long-term...
Junkie.
Right, exactly. One possible long-term solution to the situation at the border is to legalize illicit narcotics coming from Central and South America, such that a more humane infrastructure can be set up here to deal with that problem.
Well, so that the profit
and
is gone.
So that the profit is gone, such that conditions in all of the countries, really, from the border with Mexico all the way south into South America, Colombia specifically.
Ecuador,
Peru,
Bolivia.
Such that conditions in those countries are improved as well. Sounds like you're making an argument for more for United States investment in Central and South America.
Well, it's not just an argument about investment. It's an argument about the United States getting the hell out of the politics of that region. The Monroe Doctrine on, the United States essentially was running and making the rules for all of Latin America. And it got away with it because it was the most powerful nation in the region.
Mm-hmm.
So really, this is at root a part of American imperialism dating back way back into the 1800s.
So obviously we can't change any of that.
Yeah, we can.
No. We can't go back and change what's already been done.
Oh, we can't change what's already been done. We can change the rules.
We can install
a government that assures democracy and doesn't mess with other peoples, that engages in fair trade. We can do that.
Yeah, we could do that.
And we should do that.
And at the very least, we should not be separating parents from their kids.
Well, that's at the localist and most basic level. What we are doing is creating a kind of kinder, gentler concentration camps for children. I mean, what is that? And when I make reference to the making the beds and marching in line and not letting the kids hug each other, it's not a small thing. It's militarization of these children. Here are people who are suffering from all kinds of trauma, and we then teach them how to be prisoners. And these little kids. And this is really stupid and really horrible, and it's going to have a long-term effect, not just of hatred for the U.S., but an alienation from self. It's very, very, very awful.
Yeah, lives lived with a certain amount of dysfunction. because of the imprint left by this sustained traumatic experience.
Yeah, and an unnecessary traumatic experience. That's really what's important here. I mean, there are things that happen to people all over the world that are horrible, and some of them are not the responsibility of the United States. But this clearly is. And this is just about meanness and racism, and it's just being carried out by a fascist who has somehow, through Russian manipulation, become president of the United States.
It's an appalling situation, Joe.
Yeah, yeah. It's not democracy.
No, it isn't. I want to follow up on something you just said, which I think is very important to understanding this whole situation. We're talking about a series of cruelties being inflicted upon a defenseless population, a population of children, so that the racial animus embraced by a certain chunk of the American electorate can be fed, and so that a mistaken worldview that's held by that same chunk of the American electorate, which says that the root of problems in the United States right now, the biggest threat to life as we know it in the United States of America, is not the concentration of wealth in the hands of the very few, is not the wholesale theft of the machinery of government by a moneyed elite, and is not the emergence of a transnational executive class whose prerogatives eclipse those of nation states. It's none of those things. The biggest threat, according to this chunk of the electorate, is brown people coming over the border, coming to hurt you, coming to rape your daughters, coming to take your jobs, coming to dirty the United States of America, to drive down wages, to take jobs away from Americans who deserve them. That's the narrative that is being fed by this intolerable and cruel situation at our border right now.
Well, obviously, and I think that any kind of denial of that or arguing that it's a consequence unintended is missing the point. This guy, and this is really important, we now know definitively that the Russian bots and trolls and so on manipulated our election effectively to discourage persons of color from voting, to encourage certain populations to vote, to create lies that had a life of their own, just so that they could get in power a guy like Trump, who is not only a fascist, but an incompetent fascist, thank God, who will soon, I believe, go down.
And we learned also this last week that the Russian voter suppression effort that reached its peak in the weeks before the election in 2016 was targeted primarily at supporters of Bernie Sanders and at African-American voters.
Right, but it went beyond that. It attempted to discourage people from voting. And now it turns out, looking at the number of these fake things going on the internet, it turns out that it's increased after the election of Trump. So it's still going on. It's still very popular, and it's still being carried out by the Russian government. And it's something that's out of control. And part of the reason, and I don't want to make a deal out of this, but part of the reason I'm really reluctant to use the internet the way a lot of people use it is because I don't want to put myself in that world. I don't want to be part of that support network in any way that is essentially foreign controlled and deliberately creating lies about the world.
Yeah. I have to say, though, and we've mentioned this a few times on this program, that the way the Russian influence campaign was waged, the way they were able to first gather their nuggets of information from Cambridge Analytica, the British research firm, through that Facebook poll that was administered all those many years ago, it's an incredibly sophisticated and intricate and, I have to say, really well-executed campaign. I'm not condoning anything the Russians did. I'm saying what they did was incredibly subtle and incredibly effective.
Well, they're not stupid.
They're not stupid. But that begs the question, a lot of people who fell for this might be characterized in that way.
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, it was that sophisticated that many people... Look, there was a third-party candidate running on the green ticket. Mm-hmm. We have pictures of her in the same community of people in Moscow being hosted there and encouraged. That effort to support the Green Party clearly was supported and became bigger than it naturally would have been by the use of, and this is going to make a lot of progressives a little upset. The fact of the matter is it was exploited, not intentionally by the candidate, but by the Russians to create a a body of voters who would not be supporting Hillary Clinton. I'm not defending Hillary. That's not my point. It was a manipulation to make sure that Trump would win.
I don't understand what you're getting at here. You're saying that Jill Stein, the Green Party candidate, was complicit in this effort?
Not consciously.
No,
but she was used. She was used. There's no question about that.
Oh, see, I don't know anything about this argument that you're making.
I don't have time to go into it, but it's becoming more and more obvious that the Green Party, in this context, was used to siphon votes away from the Democrats and for example, encourage disinformation and distortion that would lead people to be voting in a pointless third-party effort so that Hillary would not be the viable potential candidate for president of the United States. I'm not defending Hillary Clinton. She's just another part of the game. But her politics were far more humane and far more reasonable than the fascism of Donald Trump.
Let's go to the phones. Thomas, you're next.
Yeah, hi.
Morning.
Listen, I've got to plead ignorance here, but I've got a question for you. You're saying that the Russians influenced the election. Okay, I kind of get that, you know, but, you know, these people are always playing games like this.
No. This is a new thing. This is all made possible by the Internet.
Okay, all right. Okay, a given. I'm just saying, I'll give you guys that. But here's my question. I don't understand how they influenced it. And I'm pleading ignorance here. I just want your comments. How did they influence it when Hillary actually got more votes than Trump and it was the Electoral College that selected Donald Trump? How did the Russians do that?
All they really needed to do, given the existence of our antiquated electoral system, was to nudge things a sufficient amount in the right sort of places with the right sorts of people to tip the outcome in Trump's favor. And it was a long shot even then.
And it's important to understand, where did they concentrate their effort? They concentrated their effort in the old industrial states, in the so-called Rust Belt, which Hillary stupidly ignored. And in fact, the whole effort by the Russians was extremely sophisticated. And it went through a gamut of organizations where it was relevant. They had a fake anti-persons of color organizations. Where it was relevant, they had fake pro-black groups discouraging voting for Hillary Clinton. They did this a lot, and they're still doing it. And this is a very scary thing. And under this administration, who absolutely loves dictators, this is going on, and it's going on, and it's going on. And I don't know that the United States is going to stop it.
Okay, listen, but I hear what you're saying, but I just don't get how they influence. How does that, now, maybe this is beyond this particular topic, but how did they influence the Electoral College?
They didn't. The Electoral College is simply the antiquated way that was created by the founding fathers to make it not a direct democracy.
Okay, but that's a handful of people. That's just a handful of people. How did they make those people cast their votes for Donald Trump? Does that
happen? They have to. No, wait a minute. This is the Electoral College is responding in a way that's constitutionally required. They supported the candidates under the Electoral College system. That is a different question than the question of how the Russians operated. The Russians operated on the popular front.
Okay. All right. Okay, very good. Thank you.
Sure.
Okay.
I don't know that I helped him, but
I think. But that's an important thing to understand in this larger question. The Electoral College, it's not as if the vote has been percolated down to the members who make up the Electoral College, and then they go to the polls and
decide
cast the
for themselves.
They don't. In most states in the union, not all of them, if you're an elector, if you're a member of that state's Electoral College, you are required to cast your electoral vote based on the popular vote turnout in your state. So in Oregon, all our electors cast their votes in favor of whatever candidate won the state. And that's how it is in almost all of the 50 states. There's a handful that where you can split the electors, but I couldn't tell you off the top of my head who they were or which states they are. Let's go to Corey. Good morning.
Corey. Hey, good morning, guys. How are you guys doing?
Fine.
Pretty
what's,
good.
What's
how
on
you
your
doing,
mind?
Man?
I'm calling you guys from Texas. I talked to you guys before.
Yeah.
This Portland a little bit. But I just wanted, you guys are talking about the voters. I just got through teaching a course. I'm working on my PhD, and what I keep seeing is that, you know, especially with young people, you know, I keep hearing that the young people, you know, they're going to come and make change, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm realizing more and more that some of these young people are really influenced by ignorance. I had a student turn in a paper, and it was basically nothing but Alex Jones and InfoWars. And then when I questioned them on this isn't proper academic sources, they got upset. And I just think we're in a dangerous time now when, you know, people are talking about the youth vote and the young people, but I'm seeing more and more this sort of, yeah, you know, I got an InfoWars bumper sticker. They're thinking that this stuff, they don't even know they're being manipulated. And I think that there's this whole, the civic ignorance is nothing new, but I think it's come to the point now where, you know, these people have Facebook, Twitter, et cetera, and the student was upset that, you know, she got a negative tweet. I'm like, hey, guess what? You don't have to have a Twitter account. And even that, you know, became contentious because she was like telling me, well, I have to do this because, you know, I have to have these social media accounts because that's how I contact my friends. Well, your friend is sitting right next to you. You can talk to him. They're like, no, that's too intimate. So I'm just like realizing that, you know, more and more, as much faith as I have in the youth, I'm seeing there is a definite pushback, and this anti-intellectualism has really taken a definite hold in America, to the point to where we have the person that's the president right now. And I just think that we're not talking enough about the voters, because this anti-intellectualism is really seeping through. I mean, from a place where you go from Portland and see it, and then come to Houston, Texas, and see the same thing, it's very dangerous as far as I'm concerned.
I agree. I think you're describing a phenomenon that's far-reaching and really frightening in its scope, and that is that there's a significant chunk of Americans who experience reality in a fundamentally different way than everybody else does. They've come to believe that a separate set of facts actually describes what's going on in the world rather than you know, the set of empirical facts that most people use to get through their lives every day. And they're even able to point to something that happens in the real world and deny that it actually happened, and instead claim that it's fake news. This is a problem. You're absolutely right.
Well, I appreciate you guys' feedback, and I miss you guys, and I'll be listening to you online forever.
Thanks, man. I appreciate the call. Yes, this post-truth world in which we now live. Yeah, everyone's entitled to their own facts.
But you can order stuff so cheap online.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
Okay.
All right, let's go to Mark. Good morning.
Mark, hey guys, how you doing?
Pretty good. What's on your mind?
Hey, I was going to say, Abe, as a fellow Gen Xer, I salute you. Joe, you're a silent generation guy. You're kind of like my mother-in-law. Don't be silent. I love it.
I'm not sure whether that's a compliment or an insult.
It's a total compliment. Children are depression. But what I wanted to say is we should all just give a good shout-out to the people who had those bumper stickers in the 90s that said, kill your television. They were right. We got a television president. We got to change it. You guys have a good day.
All right. Thanks a lot for the call.
The same.
No, more and more, I got to say this, and I know a lot of people are going to be upset with me, and I know you disagree with me. If you got rid of all of the internet nonsense, you would not lose knowledge in the real sense. You would not be harmed in the real sense. The only thing that would be changed is you wouldn't be able to buy the bargains online. That's it.
Oh, no, you're absolutely incorrect on that.
I'm not going to waste your time telling you. We don't have time to argue.
Although I will point out, though, that you definitely have a lot of mother-in-law kind of qualities to you.
Mother-in-law?
Joe. Yeah, definitely.
Is that a sexist thing? What are you saying? I don't get it. I'm not getting it. I'm missing something here.
Andrew is next. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, guys. I just wanted to tie in the last couple of comments together and then ask a question to the group. So,
well, good luck with that, man.
Thanks. So as far as the caller who previously was asking about how the Russians influenced the election, you know, there's a big disconnect for some, and the last caller was even mentioning it, where the generational divide is, and there's a ton of disinformation that's out there, and you know, the way that I saw the Russians influencing this election was through these disinformation campaigns, especially in the social media, making fake accounts to where they're all flocking together. If that last caller wants to look into the couple of terms, astroturfing and forum sliding, I think he might learn a little bit about how...
Yeah, and I'm going to interrupt you for just a second and let you go back to saying, I want to point out that this process by the Russians is being done more now than during the election.
Exactly. Yeah, big problem. that's a big problem. And you know, I forgot what else I was going to say, so I'll let you guys talk this one off the air. Thanks for doing what you do.
Yeah, thank you very much for the call.
Yeah, I feel like there's an unasked and unanswered question kind of lurking in the background of all this. People are wondering how was Russia able to mount a social media campaign large enough in scope and effective enough in execution to sway an American election? As I mentioned briefly earlier, it goes back to a firm called Cambridge Analytica. This is a British data analysis firm that obtained from Facebook information.
Excuse me, Facebook?
From Facebook.
Would that be Facebook, like online?
Yeah, you know what Facebook is.
Yeah, I damn well do.
Yeah, you damn well do. Facebook sold this information on more than 50 million users to Cambridge Analytica. This was several years ago.
Right.
This data was the result of this rather complex personality test that people took. And as a result of Cambridge Analytica's subsequent analysis of this personality test, they were able to target with almost surgical precision advertisements that appealed to people. And they were able to do this so effectively because they essentially had this person's, every 50 million people's responses to this personality test. So that's how they were able to do it.
Facebook
sold this data.
I got it. I just want to emphasize that.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Facebook sold the data to a company that sold the data to the Russians. Okay.
Exactly.
Just want to be clear.
All right. Let's go to Oliver. Good morning.
Good morning, gentlemen. How are you?
I'm pissed off. But
yeah, I'll tell you. I got to tell you, it's increasingly more difficult for me to listen to you guys.
I'm sorry, man. I try to make it funny, but, you know, it ain't funny.
Oh my goodness. You really do Kibu an injustice. But listen, I'm...
Wait a minute. What?
Yeah, you do Kibu a major injustice when you guys talk like this. I'm with the Pacific Green Party.
Uh-huh.
Okay? Ah. And I've listened to you for 2 years. You guys jab, needle, and take swings at us.
And poke.
And
don't forget poking.
Swings, and you're taking a swing at Our Lady, Dr. Jill Stein. And it is absolutely absurd to imply that her 1% had anything to do with the demise of what the Hillary Clinton corruption did and what they did to Bernie Sanders. Now listen, I am very active. I've been following this, okay? And the burners, the Democrats, flipping because they were so ticked off at the corruption that was exposed, that WikiLeaks published. It wasn't Russian hackers, guys. You've been saying that for 2 years. That it made people, the burners voted for Trump, and a number of them went to Gary Johnson, Governor Johnson. He ended up getting almost 5%. So you can't blame the Russians on all that.
Well, first of all, it is a combination of ugly events and ugly activities that produced the situation. There's no question that Hillary Clinton ran an incompetent campaign. And there's no question the Democratic Party, as it presented itself then, was not progressive. And there's no question the Green Party, Pacific Greens and others, are progressive. I'm saying, and I'm not accusing Jill Stein of some conspiracy here, I'm saying that frequently people in third-party situations are turned into the tools of the opposite of politics. But I can see your concern, and I don't mean to, I don't know her, I don't mean to diss her per se.
Well, it's insulting. It's just insulting.
Well, you know, it's really politics, rude. And I don't mind being guys, insulting. So,
you guys, you're sounding like, you know, the 1950s Red Scare boogeymen that the Russians are under all of our beds ready to take our children.
Look,
and
dude,
it's pathetic.
It is beyond dispute. It is beyond dispute. That Russian intelligence agencies, many of them acting in concert, launched a systemic and systematic attempt to sway the outcome of an American election, primarily through a very sophisticated social media ad campaign.
And they're still doing it.
Sir, it was not just Russia. It was Israel. We have Russian-Israel alliances. You guys always leave out Israel in the big picture.
Okay, I don't have Russian time. I don't have time for that argument. I really don't. It opens up a whole other field of discussion, and I'm just we're out of time. I maybe I should put together a show on the Stein campaign and where it went, and the fact that she was hosted by Moscow, which might mean something. Anyway, we're running out of time. I want to thank you all for your patience. I hope I haven't been too angry, and I hope you have a good sense of humor, and I hope you're ready to use your head in this next series of elections.
And whatever holiday you observe over the winter period, I hope it's a happy one.
Whatever holiday I observe?
Holiday that our listeners observe.
I already missed it. I mean, Hanukkah's over.
Oh, well, I hope it was good, those of you who observe Hanukkah.
Yeah, well, you know,
all right.
Candles, eight of them.
Take care, you guys. We'll be back at you soon. From the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming to the USA.
This is Christmas. On Monday, December 24th, Prison Pipeline hosts will feature your holiday messages to your loved ones in prison, as well as greetings from prisoners for those on the outside. Email your message to kbooppc@gmail.com or snail mail your holiday message to KBOO Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon 97214. Then tune in on Monday, December 24th at 6:30 p.m. Again, that's kbooppc@gmail.com or mail KBOO Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon 97214. And happy holidays from the Prison Pipeline Collective every Monday evening at 6:30 p.m.
Yo. KBOO is excited to be part of the 2018 Willamette Week Give Guide. This year, Willamette Week and KBOO are challenging our community to give with their dollars and take